Oftentimes, it's better to start with creativity to help you learn the facts.
Life is too short to learn a list of 1,000 rando words.
From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In with your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who is the dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Hello, Dr. Say No to Violence Pope.
I will agree with that one. Say no to violence.
Yeah, that was an easy one. So we're going to be talking about real violence in schools, particularly the people who are in the environment as opposed to the direct victims. But I wanted to get started softer.
Okay.
So you have children.
I do.
Did you let them watch violent movies?
Great question. We were very vigilant about watching violent movies or playing violent video games. So that was the rule in our house, that first-person shooter games, where, so I don't know if everyone understands what that is, but like in a video game, if you're...
Everybody plays video games.
Okay, but first-person shooter games is where you are doing the killing, and some of them are really realistic, like they were made for the army. So we monitored that, and we monitored movie violence and even TV violence, actually.
So what age did they get to see Star Wars?
That's a good question. Star Wars, the old version of Star Wars, is actually less violent than some of the newer Star Wars movies, because like the technology and all to show the realism. So the old one, I think probably 11 or 12.
So why you didn't let them see violent shows because you thought it would be horrifying to them, or you thought it would be desensitizing to them?
Right. So what I knew, at least at the time on the research, was that watching violent TV or violent movies or playing violent video games wasn't that it made you a more violent person, but that it desensitized you to the violence. It could potentially make you less empathetic. And I thought the world does not need less empathetic people in it. We need more empathetic people in it, and I will do my part.
Very good. So if I hear about violence, I become desensitized in the sense that I am less empathetic for the victim?
Well, I don't know if it's if you hear about it. I think it's the, you know, for instance, they were allowed to read books that had some tough scenes in them earlier than they were allowed to see it play out on a movie screen or a video screen. So
interesting.
I think it's something about really feeling like you're part of it, you're there. But I don't know all the details, but I just, from what I've read, this was the right thing to do. And I will tell you too, personally, I do not like to see very, very violent films. In fact, there are certain films, and I love to see the Oscar contenders. I grew up in LA. Oscar night was a really big night in my family. We would always do Taken and sit around and watch. But and I like to pride myself on seeing like most of the Oscar movies that get nominated. And there are some each year that I just say, I know it's a great film, but it's just too violent, and I just don't want to do it. I don't want to put myself through it. I don't like how it makes me feel.
Interesting. You know, for me, it's horror movies.
I don't like those either.
I won't go to horror
movies.
I won't either. So I've always worried about violence in movies with my kids, and I was more worried about sort of their emotional reaction to it at the moment rather than the long-term consequences. But then I got in a car crash.
Okay, that's horrible.
Well, the violence, the actual experience of the violence was so much greater than what the movies could do.
Did you have a kid in the car?
No.
Okay.
No, and it wasn't my fault.
And it was, okay, good, good to note. And you were okay. You were totally okay. Yes?
I was, but the sheer force of it, the sound, you know, I'll never forget it. The trauma.
Wow.
I don't think I was traumatized.
So the real, okay, but have you seen some of the really, really high-tech movies and games out there that they try to make it as realistic as possible? You think even now there's nothing that compares?
Even in the movie theater with the super sound
and
all around you.
And the seats rumbling.
There's something about the twisting metal and it's too
scary.
Much.
Really, really scary.
So this is a concern though. You know, when people experience violence directly or even indirectly. And so we fortunately have a world's expert on this topic. We have Professor Maya Rosen-Slater. So welcome.
Thank you.
She's a professor of health research and policy at Stanford. She's also a faculty fellow at something called CEPR, which is the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research. And she works in questions of health, public, and labor economics. Because she's an economist, you have to use the word labor. She focuses on issues in particular about maternal and child well-being and policies that are supposed to help disadvantaged populations.
Yay. Hooray. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
It's nice to have someone I never feel like I do important stuff. You know, when I hear this
okay,
this
Dan,
is
that's
this is
for
meaningful.
Another show. You do important stuff too. Just
no,
different. My
inadequacy is a good topic for any show.
But, we'll do a whole show on your inadequacy.
So tell us a little bit about your study.
Sure. So I'm an economist, as you mentioned, and broadly speaking, I'm interested in understanding factors, policies, environmental shocks that affect the well-being of children, of families, of mothers specifically as well. And what brought me to the topic of violence more generally, and school shooting specifically, which is the focus of the study that I'll be talking about, is just the growing prevalence of these events in our society today. You know, the statistics is something like more than 240,000 students have been at schools that have had shootings since the Columbine shooting in the late 1990s. So over the last 20 years, basically, 144 people have been killed as a result of school shootings.
And this is an increase?
And this is an increase. So I think in 2018, which is just 2 years ago now, 2018 had more school shootings than any of the prior years. So it's a highly frequent event. And so that led me to think, okay, these are things that are sort of become kind of, unfortunately, almost like a new normal in American society. And we know actually very little about how they affect kids and families. And so I wanted to use the tools of applied microeconomics, which is the tools that I use to study all kinds of questions about child health and well-being and families and policies targeting families, to really understand what are the broader consequences of these violent events on kids today.
And these are not the kids who've been shot. These
right.
are everybody else in
right.
the school.
So the motivation to some extent behind the project was, you know, when we think about violence and school shootings and mass shootings specifically, the costs of these events to the direct victims are undeniable, unfathomable. To the victims, to the people who are killed, to the people who are physically injured, to their, you know, families. And a lot of the discussion surrounding these events tend to some extent, rightfully focus on these direct victims. But the unfortunate reality is that many more individuals are exposed to shootings or exposed to violence less directly and survive. And they might not even be, you know, physically hurt in any sort of tangible way. But we know very little about what happens to them in terms of their mental, emotional well-being later on. You know, we have journalistic accounts, like we know, for example, that, you know, in the year or two following the Parkland shooting, there were at least two suicides among survivors. So it's clear that there's drastic, you know, traumatic effects of these events. And the goal of my research was to bring you know, the methodology of analyzing kind of big data sets to try to really quantify these impacts on a larger scale, to say something about, okay, so what's the broader cost of school shootings on individuals who are exposed to them but are not directly kind of physically hurt or killed.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We're speaking with Maya Rawson Slater about the effects of school shootings, not just on the actual victims, but on everyone basically in the school community. So tell us what you did.
Right. So it's not like you can go out and survey everybody.
Right. So, so we did not have any contact with individuals who were exposed to shootings. Instead, as a first pass, what we did is we used data on almost all prescription drugs in the United States that are filled at local retail pharmacies. So there's data that exists on this, and specifically we focused on antidepressants. Antidepressants are clinically advised for both treatment of, you know, major depressive disorder, but also for treatment of PTSD, which is something that we think would be affected by something like a school shooting. And what we did is, in that data, we had information on the people who prescribed these drugs, so the providers, the doctors most usually, who prescribed these drugs, and we knew where they were located. So we looked at antidepressant prescriptions that were made by providers who were located in close vicinity of schools that experienced shootings. And we compared them both before to after the shooting occurred, and then also to prescriptions that were made by providers located further away from the shootings, and those located at other similar types of schools, so similar in terms of their socioeconomic and demographic composition, for example, but that did not experience any shooting during this time period.
That's a lot of smart controls.
Yes, we tried to be very careful. We tried to be very careful to sort of account for the fact that, you know, even though it might seem to some extent that school shootings are a random event, you know, statistically they're not completely random. They are much more likely to occur in less advantaged locations, for example, in lower socioeconomic communities.
So these were prescriptions by pediatricians, or?
These were prescriptions by anybody who can prescribe. So, for instance, pediatricians can prescribe, family medicine doctors can prescribe, psychiatrists
can
prescribe.
So you just know the number of prescriptions that were filled.
That's right. Yeah. And we knew the ages. Them? We knew the location of the provider who prescribed them, and we also knew the ages of the patients who were receiving.
Oh, you did know the ages of the patients.
That's why we were able to look at children and youth. So we looked at our primary kind of group that we looked at were individuals under age 20.
So how much did it go up?
So we found that in the 2 years following a fatal school shooting, so these are school shootings that result in at least one victim death, the antidepressant prescription rate increased by 21%. And this effect persisted over the next year as well. So 3 years out, we still saw a heightened rate of antidepressant prescription drug use in the local vicinity surrounding schools that experienced fatal shootings.
So just so I can get a scale of 20%, what is the base rate here? Like one prescription per 20 kids is what normally happens? Or?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So those estimates are not that easy to find, actually, because we don't have really great data on untreated mental illness, right? Mm-hmm. It's hard to know kind of what's the baseline of who requires prescriptions and who gets them. But I think the best estimates is something like 1 out of 10 or so like that. 1 out of 10, 1 out of 15 have some kind of mental health prescription.
So 20% would be two more.
Yes.
Two more
like
out of 10 or
yes,
15.
Yes.
Wow, that's
like
a
that.
Lot.
Yeah. You know, and again, because we didn't have any information on, of course, the identities of the individuals in our data, nor did we know exactly, you know, who was enrolled in the actual schools that experienced the shootings. Our data didn't have information on schools that people attend. We can't say exactly, you know, this is happening, you know, amongst the students at these schools, but it's highly likely given that the providers that they're getting these prescriptions are located so close.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We are talking with Maya Rawson Slater about the sort of unseen victims, I would say, of school shootings, kids who end up needing to be prescribed medication for mental health issues in those areas. And there's a study that Maya did that, you know, it's a higher percentage of kids getting on these mental health drugs in order to help them when they are in that area of a school shooting. So it's a little tricky, right? Because you don't know exactly.
Can I just interrupt and say?
Yeah.
You're so good at summarizing where we've been.
Well, that's for the person who just got in here.
I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. I'm saying it's a very impressive thing.
Thank you, Dan.
So do you have any sense of the mechanisms that drive the increase? Like, do kids go to their doctors and say, I need antidepressants? Mm-hmm. Are the doctors doing it prophylactically? Like, do we have any sense of what's going on?
I don't think you're allowed to do it prophylactively. I mean, you can't say, I think you're going to have mental health.
Or they could overdiagnose.
Well, yeah, that's the phrase is a different. Really important question, yeah. And yeah. One that we've sort of thought about quite a lot, right? Because what we observe is prescription drug treatment. We don't observe underlying mental health. Ideally, what we would like to say is, what's the effect of a school shooting on the underlying mental health of students who are exposed? But that's something that we kind of by definition cannot measure, because we only observe the mental health of individuals who, you know, interact with the healthcare system.
Right, who seek help. There's a lot of people who don't even get to a doctor.
Absolutely. So there's at least two mechanisms that could be driving the heightened rate of antidepressant use that we find. On the one hand, it could be, you know, that these are traumatic events. They're leading more students to have mental health issues. You know, it might be somebody that had prior mental health issues, and this is sort of a triggering event that activates some of those issues. But all of that, you know, forces them to either go to their school and seek help from the school psychologist, who then refers them to a mental health provider, or their family takes them to a mental health provider. The other possible mechanism is that even if underlying mental illness was completely unchanged, like suppose that was true, it could still be the case that due to the school shooting, there's just more awareness and more sort of attention paid to mental health. And so as a result of that, you know, kids who would have otherwise gone untreated or undiagnosed are now getting referred to the mental health care system and getting treatment. So we tried to explore that a little bit. And one of the things that we found is that, you know, you might expect that these sort of diagnoses or treatment effects would be different across places that have more or fewer mental health care providers. And we looked specifically at prescribing providers and non-prescribing providers. So places that have more school psychologists and licensed social workers, these are non-prescribing mental health providers, and places that have more physicians, basically, who can prescribe drugs. And what we find is that the only places where we do not see an increase in antidepressants are places that have a higher density of non-prescribing providers, so licensed social workers and psychologists, where we think this might be happening due to substitution towards other types of mental health care treatment, like therapy.
What I didn't think about that you just made me think about is the awareness comes because so many of these shooters, people are saying, oh, this person was sick, they were mentally ill. And I didn't think that that would cause a reaction that other parents kind of look around, or other kids look around and say, wait, you know, we got to get these kids treatment now before sort of the next one happens. That never occurred to me when I read your study. Fascinating. So, Maya, we're going to take a break in a minute, but in 1 minute or
so
less.
Have there been studies around suicide and the same kinds of consequences? So if there's a suicide, there's a great fear of contagion. Mm-hmm. And then there's a push down from the system into the kids to try and prevent it. And so you could imagine after shooting, the doctors, you know, there's nobody coming to them for this treatment. They're pushing it down for the kids who come in. But how does this compare to suicide? Do we know?
Yeah, I don't think we have great data on that question. I think it's really hard to study issues of sort of contagion, so to speak, within mental health and within suicide specifically, partially because it's just really hard to identify, is it the fact that a first suicide leads to future suicides, you know, just
but,
kind of
but
that
it
network
is, it
effect.
But it is a kind of violence.
Right.
And so the question
is,
if I went and looked at prescriptions, would I see more prescriptions for mental health, for depression in schools that had suicide?
That's a great question. Yeah, I don't think we know the answer to that.
No, but you have to predict. You have to predict.
Wait, Dan's going to make you predict, but don't say it yet, because we're going to come right back. This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We will have more with Maya Rosson-Slater and her prediction next on Sirius XM.
This is Schools In.
I'm not an expert at this.
Okay.
I'm more expert than you.
When you can't read in American society, you are really left out.
With Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking today with Maya Rosson-Slater about the effects on schools, and particularly the kids in the schools, when there's a school shooting. Really interesting study where Maya found that more kids in those areas are taking prescription drugs for mental health issues than kids who haven't been in areas of school shootings. And then right before the break, Dan asked a certain question.
Oh, it was if around suicides. if you did that study, do you think you'd find similar results?
Right. So my answer to that was, well, I would have to do the study in order to answer the question.
Good answer.
But I do expect that there's some similar mechanisms going on.
And if it wasn't drugs, it might be something else. Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's a little bit interesting to say, like, at least they're getting the attention they need. It's a horrible way to do it, right? Let's bring attention in other ways, that you don't need a school shooting to cause people to focus on mental health if the mechanism is
right.
more
and
awareness.
We just don't know. You know, it's possible. My guess is that both are going on.
Yeah. More awareness, but also more suffering.
Right.
Yeah.
So say a little more about the long-term effects. Do they attenuate?
So when we look at the prescription drugs, you know, we just have a 3-year kind of follow-up window, and there it does not attenuate. So it sort of stays at this increased rate. But, you know, the important question, and it relates to the discussion we were just having, is how else are people affected, right? Like, how is just their well-being affected, both in the immediate term and then in the longer term? So in an attempt to answer that question, my co-authors and I are conducting kind of a follow-up study where we have data on all public school students in Texas, in the state of Texas, going back to the early 1990s. And this data on, you know, really rich data from school records that's linked up to their college records if they go to college, and also linked up to data on how they are in the labor market. So their wages, whether they're employed, their occupations, industries, and so on. And so this data set enables us to identify students who were exposed to shootings that occurred in Texas. So Texas is a large state and is certainly not immune to school shootings. There have been over 50 school shootings since the early 1990s in Texas. And so we're using that data in order to look at students who were enrolled in schools at the time that a shooting occurred, and compare them to students who were maybe just too old or just too young. Right, so they were not in the school during the time of the shooting, and also compare them to students in other similar schools based on their characteristics that did not experience shootings over this time period.
So help me on this. The way I would think about this naturally is, what are interventions I can do to prevent this from happening?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, maybe I'd like do active shooter training or mm-hmm. something like that. Here, what you're doing is you're showing these consequences, and it's hard to imagine there wouldn't be. And based on that information, the practical implication is to do things on afterwards. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
That's right. So, you know, I think the research that we're doing, unfortunately, cannot answer the question of what we can do to prevent shootings from happening, although that's, I think, an extremely important question. But what it can do is it can identify kind of what are the implications, what are the consequences of these events, and who are the people who are most affected. And it appears that people who are, you know, other students in these schools are in fact affected, whether it's in terms of their mental well-being or possibly kind of their educational trajectories, their economic well-being in the long term. And so identifying resources, whether that's at the school level, so having mental health care resources at schools available for students to cope with the trauma, providing access to families with more mental health care, especially families from disadvantaged backgrounds who might not have that type of say insurance coverage that provides mental health services. All of these seem to be very important in order to mitigate the potential long-term adverse effects of exposure to school shootings.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Maya Rawson Slater about the long-term impact and also the short-term impact of being at a school where there's a school shooting. And I have a question for you, Maya, which is, if you think about this in the long run, even at regular schools, where you know, regular high schools, we have a real problem with a number of school counselors. In the state of California, many schools don't have nurses. Many schools have one school counselor. I was just at a school where it's one school counselor for 750 students. Mm-hmm. There's no way There's no way that counselor can do her job with 750 students. So there are going to be kids who fall through the cracks. So what's exciting to me about your research is you're really bringing to the forefront the need for mental health resources now.
Absolutely.
And I think we should pair up and we should advertise that, you know, a lot of parents don't understand. They think, oh, there's a school counselor, like my kid's okay. Mm-hmm. But it's not, they're not getting that kind of attention.
Right.
Particularly in large schools.
Right. Particularly in more disadvantaged areas, you know, the distribution of school counselors across U.S. schools is highly unequal, where lower-income kids are much less likely to have access to any kind of mental health care. And, you know, and I think the fact that, you know, thinking through the lens of the school shootings analysis, you know, it's become the new normal. This type of violence at schools is unfortunately happening and continues to happen. And while I think that it's important to think about, you know, what we can do to curb the prevalence of this type of violence, we also have to recognize that by now there have been hundreds of thousands of students who have been exposed to this type of violence and what we can do for them and the mental health care treatment that we need to provide.
Well, and the thing that it made me realize that this week I was at a school in Connecticut where they said it was after the kids were gone. We're going to test this system. Mm-hmm. But just don't pay any attention to what we're testing, mm-hmm. right? And over the system, it said there is an active shooter, and it said like explicit directions of what everyone in the school should do. Mm-hmm. And even that made the adults around mm-hmm. me and myself, you know, you get, and we knew, they said this was like a drill mm-hmm. and there weren't even kids there. Mm-hmm. But even that makes you worried and you could feel your adrenaline mm-hmm. going up. So, I mean, this is serious stuff. I worry that we've now scared a bunch of parents and we have to wrap up the show a little bit. Is there a way to calm some folks down a little bit about the fear of sending their kids to school? I'm quite worried about what this show going to do.
You said I'm going to try.
But okay, thank you, Dan.
This is a very bad way to do it. You said about 250,000 kids, and what are there? There's 70 million kids in school right now. So what's 250 divided by 70 million?
I can't do that kind of math.
Maya, you're an economist. We need you to do it. Okay, so I'm going to go on a limb and say it's a very, 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 very small chance mm-hmm. that this is going to happen.
Absolutely. I think that's right. I think that's the right take of a message that, you know, on an individual level, the risk is very small. You know, the purpose of our research is not meant to scare people. But at the same time, the consequences are real for the people who are exposed to it, and we need to understand those consequences in order to appropriately intervene and help these children.
Maya, so interesting. Thank you so much for being here. We really learned a lot today.
Indeed.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And thank all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app, on iTunes and SoundCloud.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope on SiriusXM Business Radio. If you missed any of it, listen on demand, online, or with the SiriusXM app.